It's Dig Deep on KAXC, KBXC. I'm Heidi Holton, joined by Chuck Marone, our conservative commentator, and Aaron Brown, our liberal commentator. And we've been talking about compromise, and we want to move on a little bit, but we want to start with the Missouri compromise, right?
Yeah, I think in the last segment we talked about kind of how heroic some of these early compromises were, but it starts to break down not fairly quickly, but we see an erosion of our capacity to compromise. Aaron had mentioned in the first segment the Missouri Compromise, which essentially said for every, and correct me if I'm wrong historically here, but my essence of the Missouri Compromise was, if we're going to add a free state, we're also going to add a slave state. And at this point, like forward from Missouri west, states would have their own self-determination. Is that what it kind of was?
Yeah, it had to do with the Mason-Dixon line. And then once you go west, you're going to have this self-determination, which was a big issue because at the time you had California and Oregon becoming states, and they were free states by choice, very much so. But there were all these other states that were going to potentially come into the Union. And as we saw in Kansas and some of the things happening in Kansas, there were people pushing both, you know, essentially rushing into these states and trying to dictate the outcome of that determination, you know, and it was violent. It was bloody Kansas.
My historical recollection of the Missouri Compromise is that it was one of these like stopgap compromise, like tenuous measures. Like this thing is falling apart. It's spinning out of control.
It was the Henry Clay in the Senate, Lion of the Senate, kind of a well-known political figure, never quite got to be president, but would have been like the Ted Kennedy of his time or the Orrin Hatch, the senior senator in modern terms, was well-regarded and was trying to keep us from having to really deal with that meaty issue that still wasn't resolved, which was slavery. And the idea was, well, if we could all buy into the compromise, we could all keep doing what we want to do and believe what we want to believe, and we would never have to deal with these differences. And, of course, it came just 10, 15 years before the Civil War, and so you can historically say it was a failure. But at the time, it was really a hard-earned compromise that was a lot of people hoped would keep us out of war.
I felt like at the time there was a certain amount, I mean, there had to have been, but I from reading this, there's a certain amount of people that thought war was, in a sense, inevitable, and this was just buying time. Or like the schism was inevitable, maybe not war, but certainly a schism between these two different economic points of view. So the Missouri Compromise essentially bought us some time, but ultimately fruitless. Like we ended up in this war. We ended up with this schism. I kind of sense that what follows, I think we could call the high watermark of legislative power. We certainly had this kind of centralization of power with Lincoln and then with Johnson and Grant in Reconstruction. But then the power kind of tilted back again where it was originally centered, which was in the legislative branch. And up until World War I, we really had, I think, an emphasis on compromise being part of like a legislative process. Power was in the legislative branch, and I have to give some, and you have to give some, and we work it out together.
And I think we saw some fraying of this with Teddy Roosevelt and the progressive movement, where all of these wrongs in society were taken upon as political issues, not just as something that happened, you know, oh, some people die in factories, you know. it's just the way things are, you know. Yeah. Poor people, their kids work. They need the money. What are
States
you going to do?
Rights.
Yeah, you know.
Right.
And we laugh, kind of. It's kind of funny, but it totally was a way of life and things that we would find abhorrent by our current cultural standards were commonplace at the time, and that was the rise of the progressive movement. Well, if you're going to have a progressive movement that takes action on the problems of our day, like slavery was a problem, and the same coalition that fought slavery during the Civil War and before was the basis of the progressive movement too. It was a lot of the same figures from the same places and some of the same families. And so the progressive movement and Teddy Roosevelt kind of at the head of it, coupled with the aging and maturing of a country that now, you know, that has avoided foreign entanglements up to this point, now feels like it's got opportunities to expand into the Caribbean and to South America and
the Philippines.
And Teddy Roosevelt, who is an extraordinary figure in history for his ambition and for the kind of character he was. I say character in terms of being a really unique individual, one of these historical individuals who because he was the one who was there at that time, things changed and were different. And so then we started to see Teddy Roosevelt model what executive power might look like. And the presidents that came after him, Taft, for instance, was his successor, was not...
Tried to essentially go back.
Tried to go back, essentially, and put the genie back in the bottle. He just wanted to be like the old presidents were, which was just a nice man behind the desk who waved at people periodically and signed a few papers. But he ended up losing then to Wilson. And Wilson was more of a federal executive power, actually. Maybe not federal is the term, but executive power. And really, that kind of just started spiraling. And we were talking before, and maybe we can revisit this, talking about how it seems like the last 100 years, because that's what point we're up to here with Wilson, right, and Wilson and World War One. From World War One to now, feels like the start of a process that we're just now getting the fruits that were planted back then.
It was interesting because Teddy Roosevelt, when he was named vice president, the candidate vice president, was looked at as this kind of crazy out there renegade. He certainly had popular appeal, being with the Rough Riders and kind of this
like
guy
who was like a cowboy.
Yeah, like a cowboy. Even though he's from New York, he was the
he was a sickly boy from
right,
inner city New York.
Right.
But that was his perception.
But yeah, he is named vice president and then finds himself, you know, very quickly the president of the United States. And yes, took on what at the time was an unprecedented amount of, I think you'd say, activism or interventionism. You know, we nostalgize today Teddy Roosevelt because of some of the things he did with conservation and setting land aside for future preservation, you know, all the national parks and national monuments. And we nostalgize this. And certainly, I think, you know, in the model of the modern president, that's something that we admire. But at the time, this was incredibly controversial. I mean, no one had ever thought about doing something like this before, particularly on this scale. Then you have the military interventionism, which we are a country founded upon like the exact opposite idea. It was really controversial when Jefferson decided to defend American shipping against pirates in the Barbary Seas. I mean, this was a massively controversial thing. Now we're talking about actually going out and conquering other lands, putting down people, and doing it in the name of democracy, in the name of justice. This is not like places that really threatened our interests.
But also strategy and expansionist mindset. We could have ended up with the Dominican Republic.
Well,
we could have ended up with Cuba. You know,
I was putting the popular spin on it. It's pretty hard to not look at it as like the dawning of American imperialism, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the knock on Roosevelt. And because no figure in the few presidents that followed him were quite of the same cut in terms of popularity and mystique, we saw kind of a, like I said, with Taft, you couldn't have a more different personality than Taft after Roosevelt. And Taft was a very intelligent, very remarkable man in his own right. Here's the liberal defending
Taft.
Yeah. But because of this historical situation, he was the one trying to end the party, so to speak, that Roosevelt started. Clean up this place. We got to get mom and dad are coming home. That was Taft. And that's why no one liked Taft.
No, it's very true. And it's the reason we got Wilson because Roosevelt, of course, came up and ran against Taft as a bull moose.
No, this party is going to keep going.
Said, we're going to keep doing this. Yeah. And so with Wilson, you get make the world safe for democracy. You get essentially, I think, the first modern president. You know, Wilson ran the second time he ran for re-election, he ran on a platform of keeping us out of the war. And then very shortly after he's elected, we're in the war. And everybody kind of knew this was coming and there was a sense that this was going to happen. But the way, you know, Wilson frames the war is our boys are going over there to make the world safe for democracy. We're going to get rid of the Kaiser. We're going to get rid of the Tsar. We're going to get rid of all these behind the scenes imperialist deals going on. And we're going to free the world to be a safe place for people to democratically rule themselves. And all of a sudden, what you see from that point on, and I think maybe we could skip to FDR, but you start to see a centralization of power in the executive and compromise becoming a more elusive, ephemeral kind of thing.
And just to add one quick historical note, you can't ignore the fact that right after we get into the war, the Soviet Revolution takes place. And that sends shockwaves across the whole world, including here. such that previously what you would call even socialists, they would even call themselves socialist people here in the United States, suddenly were, you know, the first Red Scare was arguably a lot scarier than the second Red Scare. So it just creates this continuing notion of central power, external threat, and the executive is the defender against this external threat.
Right. So when you get to the New Deal, and this is where I think the whole compromise thing really takes on like a modern tinge to it. You could certainly make a case, and I don't think it's very hard, that the New Deal in the Great Depression constituted this existential crisis. Were we going to, as a country, survive the Great Depression? No one really understood why it was happening. No one really understood why to fix it. There was all kinds of kind of deep ideological division. You know, people who were conservative and who wanted the market to kind of work itself out were saying, keep your hands off and let this go. The more you intervene, the worse it gets. Other people are saying, like, look, if we don't intervene, we have people starving. We have Hoovervilles. We have, you know, all this horrible stuff going on. How can we not act? And one of, I think, the kind of defining events in terms of compromise in the Roosevelt administration was the packing the court. Roosevelt had and the Democrats in Congress had proposed all kinds of what I would just say like experimental legislation. Let's try this program and see if it works. Let's try this program. Let's try this program. And the courts, which had been largely appointed by conservatives, said, like, you can't do that. Like, that's not constitutional. Sorry. You know, you may want to do that, but you got to change the Constitution to do it. And the sense is like, we don't have time to do that. We don't have, you know, years to go through and change the Constitution. So what happened? We just added a whole bunch of more people to court. Just get, you know, imagine today.
You threatened to add them.
But they did add some.
But that was part of the deal, was the threat was to add up to 15.
Right, right.
And that would have dramatically, you know, given enormous advantage to Roosevelt in this debate, and they ended up essentially scaring the act of doing that scared the justices into acquiescing on a number of things they weren't initially interested in acquiescing on.
Right.
Yeah.
So now you have kind of, I guess, a compromise that is not really a compromise of ideals. You know, go back to the Three-Fifths Compromise, which none of us are comfortable with, but we kind of understand where it came from, but basically like a power compromise. My branch has this power. Your branch has that power. There's nothing in the Constitution that says how many justices there are. And it does say that I get to appoint them and my Senate, who's on my side, gets to confirm them. So here they come, you know? And this is really, I'm not going to pretend that like that kind of thing didn't happen before, but we started to break some unwritten rules in a sense about how you govern and how we go about things that today, part of the Kavanaugh hearings today were the Democratic Party saying, if we get back the White House, we're going to appoint two more justices just so we can tilt this, you know, balance of power back the other way. These are things that have not gone away.
I don't know that was a mainstream.
It was not a mainstream. Yeah. Nope, totally. I don't want to insinuate that it was, mm-hmm. but it certainly was one of those things that was, you know, we're going to impeach Kavanaugh and we're going to, you know, do this so we can get a different justice because we got, you know, I'm looking for like a term we can say on the radio. You know, we got the bad end of the stick with the Merrick Garland and that whole process.
Right, because, yeah, and that gets into, I think we're flashing forward a bit on the Supreme Court, because what's happened over the last 20 years with the Supreme Court is that, I don't know, when I was a kid and I had my encyclopedia that had the branches of the federal government and I assigned little animals and erasers, dinosaur erasers and there were these little teddy bears they sold at the fabric store. My mom would sew all our clothes, so we'd go to the fabric store and if we were good, we got to have a little bear. A lot of these bears ended up in my government. I would appoint all the critters to the different posts. Anyway, at the time I was of this consciousness of what the government was, I viewed the Supreme Court, and I was quite young, as this kind of benevolent institution. In fact,
I had the same point of view. Right.
So my dinosaur erasers were the Supreme Court because they were kind of bland. I didn't know what to do with them. They didn't. And I literally used dinosaurs, thinking, well, they're old critters on the on the Supreme Court, you know, and they just they're stuffy and they kind of look out for things and they
but they're above politics and they're above not political. The petty stuff.
They'll go and they'll ding you. They're like a referee. They'll ding you on something.
Yeah.
And that was my view of the Supreme Court, you know, back in the 80s when this was going on. And now I think what at least the last several vacancies under both Obama and Trump, it is assumed and it in fact is. I mean, whether it's intended to play out this way, it certainly is playing out this way. It is assumed that the justices will perform in a partisan manner. It is assumed that they will. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. It might be that the last truly nonpartisan justice ends up being John Roberts.
Sure.
Under George W. Bush, because he's been the swing vote now that Kennedy's retired. But every other justice has performed almost entirely within the context of what their party might have expected of them.
Right.
The idea that you might have justices make a legal argument to side one way or the other that might have nothing to do with their partisan beliefs or the beliefs of the president who appointed them now has kind of shifted, and now they're looking for partisan. They want
yeah. agents. Yeah, no, they want people to push agendas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting because I think after we get to the atomic era, after we get, you know, at the end of World War II, and then when the Soviet Union gets the atom bomb, now all of a sudden you as a country, you have to invest a certain amount of unchecked power in an executive. If the Soviet Union is going to launch a missile strike on the U.S., you can't convene Congress and have votes and resolutions. Someone's got to act within 30 seconds to make a decision on how to retaliate or how to not retaliate or what to do. And so what you see is that this institution of the presidency that was meant to be kind of an equal, but yet quite subordinate institution to the legislative branch, all of a sudden now becomes the institution, like the large player. And what it's done is it's changed the nature of compromise. Compromise is no longer, there's all these different southern, northern, coastal, inner, you know, Midwestern coalitions, conservatives, blue dogs. You got all these different things in Congress trying to work messy stuff out. What you have is, what's compromise today? Compromise today is the executive compromising with the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader. That's what compromise is. And what we see is that even though we have, I think in many ways, smaller issues we're trying to compromise over, and I'm not going to pretend that healthcare is an easy issue or immigration is an easy issue, but it's a heck of a lot easier than, like, you know, how are we going to be represented in this country? We can't reach anything even resembling a compromise. And I feel, and this is, I think, the debate we might have in the next segment, part of it is this centralization of power. It's a direct result of the fact that we actually only have a very small number of people making huge decisions today.
It's Dig Deep. That's Chuck Marone, along with Aaron Brown. We'll continue on with compromise. I think we'll find out what kind of games Chuck played with his dinosaur races next time.
The president was an owl.
Mine were Star Wars figures, so it was easy to determine good and evil there.